discovered shoals of a little-known fish living at a depth of about half a mile on their continental shelves. They were known as orange ruffy. They were delicious, and they existed in huge numbers. In no time at all, fishing fleets were hauling in 40,000 metric tons of ruffy a year. Then marine biologists made some alarming discoveries. Ruffy are extremely long-lived and slow maturing. Some may be 150 years old. Any ruffy you have eaten may well have been born when Victoria was queen. Ruffy have adopted this exceedingly unhurried lifestyle because the waters they live in are so resource poor. In such waters, some fish spawn just once in a lifetime. Clearly, these are populations that cannot stand a great deal of disturbance. Unfortunately, by the time this was realized, the stocks had been severely depleted. Even with careful management, it will be decades before the populations recover, if they ever do. Elsewhere, however, the misuse of the oceans has been more wanton than inadvertent. Many fishermen fin sharks, that is, slice their fins off, then dump them back into the water to die. In 1998, shark fins sold in the Far East for over $250 a pound. A bowl of shark fin soup retailed in Tokyo for $100. The World Wildlife Fund estimated in 1994 that the number of sharks killed each year was between 40 million and 70 million. As of 1995, some 37,000 industrial-sized fishing ships, plus about a million smaller boats, were between them taking twice as many fish from the sea as they had just 25 years earlier. Trawlers are sometimes now as big as cruise ships, and haul behind them nets big enough to hold a dozen jumbo jets. Some even use spotter planes to locate shoals of fish from the air. It is estimated that about a quarter of every fishing net hauled up contains bycatch, fish that can't be landed because they're too small, or of the wrong type, or caught in the wrong season. As one observer told The Economist, we're still in the dark ages. We just drop a net down and see what comes up. Perhaps as much as 22 million metric tons of such unwanted fish are dumped back in the sea each year, mostly in the form of corpses. For every pound of shrimp harvested, about 4 pounds of fish and other marine creatures are destroyed. Large areas of the North Sea floor are dragged clean by beam trawlers as many as 7 times a year, a degree of disturbance that no ecosystem can withstand. At least 2/3 of species in the North Sea, by many estimates, are being overfished. Across the Atlantic, things are no better. Halibut once abounded in such numbers off New England that individual boats could land 20,000 pounds of it in a day. Now halibut is all but extinct off the northeast coast of North America. Nothing, however, compares with the fate of cod. In the late 15th century, the explorer John Cabot found cod in incredible numbers on the eastern banks of North America, shallow areas of water popular with bottom-feeding fish like cod. Some of these banks were vast. George Banks off Massachusetts is bigger than the state it abuts. The Grand Banks off Newfoundland is bigger still, and for centuries was always dense with cod, though they were thought to be inexhaustible. Of course, they were anything but. By 1960, the number of spawning cod in the North Atlantic had fallen to an estimated 1.6 million metric tons. By 1990, this had sunk to 22,000 metric tons. In commercial terms, the cod were extinct. Fishermen, wrote Mark Kurlansky in his fascinating history, Cod, had caught them all. The cod may have lost the Western Atlantic forever. In 1992, cod fishing was stopped altogether on the Grand Banks, but as of last autumn, according to a report in Nature, stocks had not staged a comeback. Kurlansky notes that the fish of fish fillet and fish sticks was originally cod, but then was replaced by haddock, then by redfish, and lately by Pacific pollock. These days, he notes dryly, fish is whatever is left. Much the same can be said of many other seafoods. In the New England fisheries off Rhode Island, it was once routine to haul in lobsters weighing 20 pounds. Sometimes they reached 30 pounds. Left unmolested, lobsters can live for decades, as much as 70 years, it is thought, and they never stop growing. Nowadays, few lobsters weigh more than 2 pounds on capture. Biologists, according to the New York Times, estimate that 90% of lobsters are caught within a year after they reach the legal minimum size at about age 6. Despite declining catches, New England fishermen continue to receive state and federal tax incentives that encourage them, in some cases all but compel them, to acquire bigger boats and to harvest the seas more intensively. Today, fishermen of Massachusetts are reduced to fishing the hideous hagfish, for which there is a slight market in the Far East, but even their numbers are now falling. We are remarkably ignorant of the dynamics that rule life in the sea. While marine life is poorer than it ought to be in areas that have been overfished, in some naturally impoverished waters, there is far more life than there ought to be. The southern oceans around Antarctica produce only about 3% of the world's phytoplankton, far too little, it would seem, to support a complex ecosystem, and yet it does. Crab-eater seals are not a species of animal that most of us have heard of, but they may actually be the second most numerous large species of animal on Earth, after humans. As many as 15 million of them may live on the pack ice around Antarctica. There are also perhaps 2 million Weddell seals, at least 500,000 emperor penguins, and maybe as many as 4 million Adélie penguins. The food chain is thus hopelessly top-heavy. But somehow it works. Remarkably, no one knows how. All this is a very roundabout way of making the point that we know very little about Earth's biggest system. But then, as we shall see in the pages remaining to us, once you start talking about life, there is a great deal we don't know, not least how it got going in the first place. 19. The Rise of Life. In 1953, Stanley Miller, a graduate student at the University of Chicago, took two flasks, one containing a little water to represent a primeval ocean, the other holding a mixture of methane, ammonia, and hydrogen sulfide gases to represent Earth's early atmosphere, connected them with rubber tubes, and introduced some electrical sparks as a stand-in for lightning. After a few days, the water in the flasks had turned green and yellow in a hearty broth of amino acids, fatty acids, sugars, and other organic compounds. If God didn't do it this way, observed Miller's delighted supervisor, the Nobel laureate Harold Urey, he missed a good bet. Press reports of the time made it sound as if about all that was needed now was for somebody to give the hole a good shake and life would crawl out. As time has shown, it wasn't nearly so simple. Despite half a century of